Good afternoon. It's a great privilege to be, however briefly, for the second time in as many days, sandwiched between Francois and Jancis, getting a send-off like that. It's also, I have to shamefacedly admit, a pleasure to be in Oregon for the first time in my life, by which you can tell that I'm not here on account of my expertise in Oregonian Pinot Noir, although I had actually some considerable involvement with the wines back in the 1980s when the region was just emerging. However, what we're going to try to do this afternoon is especially look at the wines in front of you from the aspect of terroir. I think we almost have to apologize for using the T word now because it's become so overused. So I am going to try to pin Francois down a number of occasions. We'll try to make the concepts as concrete and, of course, stony as we possibly can for you. The protocol is going to be, Francois is going to give you a little introduction to his domain, specifically from the aspect of geology and other matters important to the discussion of terroir. At that point, we would encourage you to go ahead and start tasting the wines in front of you. Experience has shown that they will evolve considerably in the time that we're sitting here. I don't necessarily recommend you tip them over dangerously like I have, but if you swish them around gently and give them some more air, this will be an excellent idea. And at that point, then, we'll give you a little introduction to the wines in front of you, and then I'm going to prompt some discussion of terroir and other aspects of the two great wines that we have on the right-hand side, the Bonnoir and the Musigny. I don't need to tell you that Burgundy is a place with not generations, but centuries of having matched a single grape to the ideal positions on a very small number of slopes, but it does perhaps bear mentioning that I'm not sure there's any other place in the world that can make a comparable claim. So if there is a place in which we can really get a grasp of the concept of terroir, insofar as it's simple, which it isn't, but as simply and dramatically as possible, I think we're in the right place today. So, Francois?
So, hello. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I will try to give you a few informations about geology at first of France, and I'm going to be the teacher, so I'll take this. So at first I thought it was interesting to situate Chambon. And on our 3 hands. So Chambon is right here, and Burgundy, of course, right here. And this is a, already you can see the unique position between the Jurassic area, Jurassic sediments, and the tertiary, the yellow. The yellow is tertiary, this is much recent. And actually, it's the part you have east, which is the plain, it's the plain of Saône, it's the main river, you have also Le Doubs, another river, but it's a plain. And that's the location of Burgundy, at the edge of what we call the Persian Basin. Paris is here. And so this is a particular position, geologically speaking. That's the same map, but with giving more evidence of the area. Again, you will see the section. The section will be the following picture. Burgundy is here. And this is the Jurassic. This is the tertiary, the plain. And in red, it's primary rock. It's essentially granitic, and it's what we call the Morvan. It's a small mountain. even more precision, and we continue to see the position, the location of the vineyards here in green, the Jurassic in yellow, in blue, and the plain in yellow, the tertiary plain. And we can see the different vineyards, the Chablis up there, Côte de Nuit, Côte de Beaune, Chalonnais, Mâconnais. So this is what happened following Jurassic time. There was a collision between the Italian plate, it's a tectonic movement, the Italian plate and the European plate, which has formed the Alps and has also lifted up the region. But in the meantime, this area, the tertiary area, collapsed and went down like this and created a big fault here, which hopefully has nothing to do with San Andreas fault. It's a calm fault, but when you have a big fault like this, we imagine you have a lot of different faults, less important, but quite a lot, in different position. It can be parallel, it can be perpendicular, and that's probably the most the big explanation why we have terroir which can be so different from one place to another. So this is a map. It's my father, who is a geologist, who did this map, and it's a geological map. I don't know if you are familiar, but each color is a layer. And this is the most ancient, and this is it's newer, but it's about 150 million years ago. So it's a way of speaking when I say this is new. But the layer is above, so it means it's new versus this one. And it's interesting already to observe the fractures, the faults here, several faults, and you can realize very quickly that the bone marrow up has a different mother rock that has Musigny and Amoureuse. You can see that Musigny and Amoureuse has Combranchien rock mostly, but bone marrow has not the Combranchien. Bone marrow has Bajoncien below, downslope, and above slope you have the white marl. This is what we call terre rouge and terre blanche inside the bone marl. So this is the profile of what we just saw. It's an approximative profile, and but it shows you again the fault here, which separate, this is the west, this way, which separate the Parisian basin from the plain, from the Saône plain, which is tertiary. The village is here, and you have the succession of layers from the bottom to the top. I hope the drawings are visible. It's an amateur drawing. This is interesting. It's where we have the same profile, but I wanted to try to explain the influence of the depth of the topsoil versus the water retention. And actually, all the premier cru, grand cru, have a middle soil position, because in this area you have a compromise between being up, where the topsoil is shallow, but where the water retention is low. And the wires are interesting, but very ethereal, and have a lack of depth and consistency. it's the opposite problem here, if we call, can call that a problem. But here, the depth of the soil is much more important, and automatically the water retention is high. And the wines, they're interesting anyway, but with a certain vigor and with maybe a lack of finesse. So that's why all, this is very schematic, but that's why all the Grand Cru, Premier Cru have a mid-ocean position, and that's why the village is either down or up. So the two extremes join themselves together. And this is the fault here and the tertiary soils, where you have Bourgogne there, generic. This is a drawing to try to explain that on the Côte de Nuit, you have, during glacial time, there was some screes taken from up and down, and that's what we call the ejection cone. We can call it a funnel.
Yeah, a fan.
A fan, not a funnel, a fan. It's like a fan. You can see this in the mountains. A fan coming from erosion, and that's a very important point, because each comb, that's the comb here, we will see pictures following. The comb has had an influence on the wines, because the screes taken down south have given drainage and given the possibility of giving more finesse to the wines. So this is a map. You have a map with just under the glass house. Let me precise that the north is not up like this, perpendicular to you. The north is on the right. So it's important to say when you see the pictures, so that you correctly orientate yourself. So that's the, not all the Premier Cru are here, but at first you can see Bonnard again, which is up north. The north is like this. Busigny being down with Les Amoureuses, and Les Charmes, Les Chabiot, Les Plantes, Les Faustotes, Les Châteaux, Les Beaubruns, Les Noireaux. It was difficult to put everything. La Vrotte, Baude, Les Sentiers, very good Premier Cru that you can taste on the campus with Domaine Cigaud, who is in the room. And so there are, let me give you quickly a metaphor. We can say that in our village, I imagine a family of wines. The family has parents. And I would say the Musigny is the patriarch of the family. It's the boss. Les Amoureuses, just beside, could be considered to the first lady of the village. That's the wife of the Musigny. These two wines are extremely representative of the village, with the profile they have. I mean the energy, lot of minerality, lot of finesse, lot of strength, but it's finesse with it's strength, but with finesse and elegance. There's never any aggressivity. Bonnard up is extremely different. Well, I should continue with the Premier Cru, sorry. The Premier Cru, and you can imagine a group of Premier Cru here, like this, which are still beside the Musigny, and on the perpendicular of the Combe, and also the Premier Cru up, which are slightly influenced by the Bonnard. The Bonnard, which is opposite, on the way to Morissandi, Bonnard being shared by the two villages, and Bonnard is very different from the family I was just describing. Imagine the Bonnard like an uncle of the family by marriage. But it's a very interesting person anyway, and very generous. But if you taste the wines, when you will taste the wine, not now, you'll see how the Brahma is so different at any point. It's a question of attitude and personality. That's a picture from the village. So, actually, if you look at the map, it's exactly this way that you have to look at the map, because this is, the cone is up like this. So the west actually is like on your map. This is the village by profile. Instead of being in front of the village, we are at the profile of the village. You can see the cone again, and the plateau up, and the rocks of Comanche, which is actually the mother rock of Musigny and Amoureuse, and of quite several premier crus. It's a tiny village, as you can see. The population is 315, and it's like a nest inside the combe. This is the Musigny. I took the picture a bit south of the Musigny. This is actually the north, like this. And it was, the purpose was to give you the three sides of the Musigny. Musigny, Musigny Petit Musigny, Musigny Combe d'Orvault. But in terms of appellation, it's exactly the same appellation. And don't try to ask me if there's a difference, because there's no difference. This is the Musigny taken from the east, if you try to orientate. So, on the map, it's exactly the same orientation that you have on the map, which is on the table. And you can see that Amoureuse is just below the Musigny, high proximity between the two terroirs. That's a picture taken from here. That was here when I took the picture. And we can see that's the old quarry used by the monks to build the castle of the Clos Vougeot. And you can see the right oreillette. And above is Amoureuse. That's, by the way, our Amoureuse, the Vauvray Amoureuse, and the Comblanchère, which is in the bushes. You can see it, but you can't believe me, it's Comblanchère here. That's the Brahma. This is the north, like this. The cone is like this, and the village. So the Brahma is shared by Chambol and Moresandi, and Brahma is a rectangle. And as I said, down slope. Well, the slope is not very steep. Down slope you have the Terre Rouge, and up slope the White Mall, Terre Blanche. Just to have a look at the Bajocien limestone, because Brahma has the Bajocien limestone instead of having the Comblanchère limestone. Again, Bajocien limestone. That's the domain, de Vauguin. That's the, quickly the, it's in hectares. Quickly the amount of hectares we have per appellation. Le Chambal, that's the one, that's the first one. Le Beau de l'Effet, it's also the first one, because we blend these three together, Amoureuse, Brahma, the White Musigny, the Red Musigny. That's just to see the location of the Brahma in purple here, that we have, that the domain has, and the Musigny over there, and in yellow is Amoureuse. And north is here, that's the north. The Combe is here.
We're going to start on your left with the village, Chambon-Musigny village. And in taking a look at this wine, I'd like to see whether François will rise to the bait to see whether there's perhaps an applicable concept of terroir or at least typicity or personality of Chambon. So, for instance, if you, François, if you were tasting in a cellar with a grower who had Bon Romane, had Maury Saint-Denis, had Chambon-Musigny, would you expect to be able to pick out the village wine from Chambon? And if so, what would be the particular characteristics of the village?
Yes. I think the difference is the fact, I don't mean that other wines not being Chambon in the Côte de Nuit are not interesting. Of course not. It's a question of personality. But the personality of our wines, of the wines, not only of the domain, but generally speaking from Chambon, have, that's what I said a bit at the start, they have the possibility of being, of having a lot of finesse, having very, very fine tannins, and having also the minerality. And the minerality is very important for these wines, because it's the fuel of the wines, it's the energy of the wines. It's not the tannicity which is the fuel of the wines. What propels the wine is this mineral energy, this freshness. And so this is slightly paradoxical, because the wines of Chambon have the sweetness that can be raspberries, sweetness, but they are also able to have there's no vulgarity because of the minerality which really drives this sweetness. And of course the balance between these two opposite components.
I kind of myself think of Chambon in terms of the sort of particular tension or energy that the wines tend to exhibit, especially if you compare them, for instance, with their neighbors to the immediate up the côte in Maury Saint-Denis, and you may see something similar to that when we compare the Grand Cru. The wine second from left here is Chambon Premier Cru, and François, this requires some explanation as to exactly what in this instance is Premier Cru.
Just something to add versus the first question. What is important is the influence of limestone that we have in our soils, subsoils of course, but also the soils, which gives that minerality. The second one, the Chambon Premier Cru, is actually coming exclusively from the young vines of the Musigny. We think Musigny is very demanding, and that's why it's a long tradition at the domain to separate the young vines from the old vines, and to bottle it, of course, separately. And it's the young vines, young meaning today, from 10 to 25. And the old vines are from 25, or I would say 26, and today 55. But that the classification can be even more drastic if depending on the vintage.
So the terroir, in effect, is the same with the Premier Cru and the Grand Cru Musigny. It's a selection from, it's your judgment as to which of these most adequately expresses that terroir. Would that be?
Yeah, the interest anyway, the Premier Cru is absolutely not sort of garbage where you don't know exactly where to put your wines. No, it's just, the first purpose is of course to identify the old vines, but it gives, I think the Premier Cru gives even more indication about the personality of the terroir. You know, it's like when you meet somebody for the first time as an adult, you don't have absolutely no background about that person, but if you have met that person in the past as a young man, you have much more reference, and it gives you much more possibilities to dialogue with him.
I don't know about you, but I've been wrestling with these geological issues and analytic issues for quite some time, and it strikes me that every time we begin discussions about terroir, we get a fascinating lesson in geology, something which is very interesting in and of itself, and then we come to the tasting, and we get often dramatic and consistent differences from one wine to another. But the X factor, the missing link, is to try to figure out what on earth it is about the geology that conduces to particular flavor characteristics. Now, I know you're not a plant physiologist, but I would like to put you on the spot to try to speculate on what you think are the important aspects of the soil that and how they might influence the flavor, because as we saw in the schematic, we understand in general terms the significance of water retention and the way in which the water is conducted to the plant, and in fact the Grand Cru are in general situated on the côte based on based on the balance between drainage and water retention. But of course what we are trying to focus on today is the difference, in fact rather dramatic difference, between two Grand Cru, roughly similar situations on the côte. So what would you say are the probable factors influencing the flavor?
Yes, the two Grand Cru, Lusigny and Bonnemare, are the same, about the same situation, being middle soil position. The two Grand Cru have about the same depth of soil, but the two Grand Cru haven't the same limestone. That's the first difference. And the topsoil, even though the topsoil is as deep, both have the same depth of topsoil. The topsoil is different. I would say the Bonnemare has a different topsoil from the Lusigny. It's not the Lusigny who has, and I say who, not which, who has a different topsoil from the Bonnemare. The topsoil from the Lusigny is has a drainage which is probably more important, sort of almost perfect drainage, combination of pebbles, of small rocks, but we have clay too anyway, we need the clay. Whereas the Bonnemare has much more clay. The drainage could be slightly less, but I don't mean that the drainage of Bonnemare is bad. I'm just comparing the drainage of Bonnemare to the drainage of the Lusigny. And that the slope is less steep. You saw this probably on the picture. The slope of Bonnemare is less steep than the slope of the Lusigny, which maybe explains the drainage. But Bonnemare is not a lake following the rain, don't worry. It's just a nuance. So maybe that the clay is giving to the Bonnemare the fruit, first the attitude of the Bonnemare, which is it's a direct attitude, it's a wild attitude. It's not like the Lusigny, which has that incredible possibility of combining the freshness, the minerality, and the sweetness together. And in terms of fruit, it's also very different. And it's not very surprising that the Bonnemare has black fruit, especially the blueberry. There's a lot of blueberry in the Bonnemare. And of course, the blueberry can be as sweet as raspberries and blackberries. In terms of flowers too, the rose for the Lusigny, that's not surprising, and the peony rose for the Bonnemare, which is a much more heady flower than the rose.
So you think perhaps there is a general relationship between the more clay-rich soils and a more powerful, low-toned, if you will, wine, and par contre with the more stony soils and exposure, perhaps more finesse and more high-toned expression?
Yeah, probably, but, you know, I'm just trying to understand. I don't pretend to give the truth today. But, you know, it can be striking that if you consider the Bonnemare and Chambertin, which is quite far away in terms of terroir, but Chambertin has exactly the same subsoil that has the Bonnemare. That's an interesting coincidence. And so probably that the subsoil we have in the Bonnemare and the amount of clay that we call it terre rouge could explain partly the attitude of the wines.
And you think that the nature of the limestone and the stony aspect of Lusigny makes the significance of age of vine especially acute in terms of the root penetration? Is there special importance for that in that site, do you think?
Well, the root penetration is about the same, Bonnard and Lusigny. When I was saying that the topsoil is shallow, it's very shallow, it's maybe 40 centimeters, 40, 50, but of course, and hopefully, the roots don't just stay at the top, they go deeply down, hopefully.
Something else I'd like to pin you down on, which may seem only tangentially related to terroir, but I believe ultimately we see a pretty intimate connection. Obviously, every vigneron is trying, every quality-conscious vigneron, to make the best possible wine. At the same time, especially in recent years, there's a lot more attention being paid to, shall we say, non-aesthetic or additional principles involving the way in which you care for your vines and the way in which you bring your wines up in the cellar. What's your relationship to the principles of organic viticulture, organic and biodynamic regimens?
The domain is en lutte intégrée. That means that we are looking to be the most organic possible. We don't use herbicides, we don't use insecticides, we don't use any more botrytis spreads against botrytis. But we don't want, we think that if obviously there's a problem going on and that the pressure of the disease is high, we think we will apply, we will spread
sparingly.
Spread a systemic, a chemical product. We will do it. We hope just once. We hope never. But we think it's difficult, you know, when you have vineyards completely destroyed by oidium. What are we going to do? Is it possible to make wines like this? But it's organic orientation. It's not biodynamic. And I'm not criticizing biodynamic. It's very courageous. And we plow with horse when it's possible. So we try also to preserve our environment.
But you would say then that there have come times in certain vintages where there is a choice that has to be made between someone who wants to be true to organic principles and somebody who wants to be able to save the crop or at least make the best possible wine.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Another hot topic out there among those of you who are winemakers, but probably among us observers too, because we've been introduced to it very extensively, is yeasts and the significance or lack thereof of relying on the ambient yeasts and also, of course, the potential or possibility that the population of yeasts in a particular vineyard is part of the expression of that terroir. What's your thought there?
So the wines you have in front of you are native yeast and native bacterium. I think I'm aware that it's a risk. There's always a risk when you don't inoculate, but maybe life is a risk. If you don't believe also in nature, it can be maybe a bit sad. But I know that it's risky not to inoculate, and I'm. If you wish, like this, knocking on the room. But I think the native yeast work. They work, they really work well. And anyway, it will be such a big decision, difficult decision, to say what type of yeast am I going to inoculate. That's the first point. The second point, very interesting, is that when you don't inoculate, you really let the fermentation start very slowly. And I think in terms of complexity, in terms of also roundness, it's very important. And also interesting is that if you start at, let's say, 15, that's 15 degrees centigrade, so I let you calculate in Fahrenheit. If you start at that level of temperature, the interest of using native yeast is that you don't have to cool down most of the time because you reach a temperature of 30, 32. So, and it's so, I hate manipulating the wines when you have that level of alcohol. I think it's very dangerous. So, native yeast gives you the possibility of being very hands-off, not only because you don't inoculate, but also because you let things go on their own. Of course, you check. And the bacterium, the mallow, is natural too.
Now, I think a topic that sort of parallels what we were just talking about in terms of viticultural and winemaking regimen, and that also has really important analogies to terroir, is the nature of vintage character. And I recall on a relatively recent occasion, a wonderful winemaker and neighbor of yours who told me, when I asked him what he had done differently from one vintage to the next in 2 years that were rather dramatically different meteorologically, he said, well, nothing, or at least as little as possible, because my aim is to hold other things equal in order to allow the vintage to express itself. Now, I'm wondering, in your practice, whether you find that there is ever a point at which the principle of allowing the vintage to express itself comes in conflict with the principle of trying to make the best possible wine, or indeed, how do you see the notion of vintage character as evolving in the course of the season?
Well, I don't pretend to have the truth again, and what I'm going to say is not a critic versus any other approaches. I don't think, personally, I'm not going to say this way, I think that we are interpreters, and we are here to try, and this is very pretentious, to try to understand what we have in our hands. But, well, it's a question of soul and conscience. So when you think to know, well, you go ahead and you continue. So if you consider Musigny and Bonnemare, and what we just said about these two terroirs, obviously when you are in front of a vat of Musigny fermenting and a vat of Bonnemare fermenting, you don't look at the same person. And I imagine it to be difficult to speak to a patriarch the same way you're going to speak to the Bonnemare being so direct, generous anyway, but Bonnemare doesn't care about being provocated, or you can joke with the Bonnemare, much less with the Musigny. I don't think you can joke with him. So if I were doing things equal versus the terroir, I will come back to the, I'll go to the vintage next. If I were doing things equal, either the Musigny would be happy and the Bonnemare would be sad, or reciprocally, vice versa. So I think Musigny, but it's my personal view, has to be handled very, very carefully so that you don't bother the boss. And it's a wine like Amoureuse which are able to be done by themselves. Of course, you have to observe and check. Bonnemare needs to be provocated. You have to talk with him. You have to tap him on the shoulder. In terms of being concrete, it's a question of punch down, for example. Bonnemare needs to be punched down. If you don't punch down, okay, it's not too problematic because you don't have any over-extraction, but you are probably on an under-expression. And under-expression, maybe it's better than over-expression, but that's why I don't think the two have to be treated the same way. And in terms of vintage, it's the same. The vintage, we have such different vintages following themselves that the vintage, imagine the vintage, the mood of the wine persons we just described. And you have to try to understand the vintage, of course. If you consider one parameter, which is the length of maceration, you can't apply this length all the time, whatever the vintage. It's very obvious. You have to adapt, and through with the tastings, you have to adapt the length of maceration. That's just one example.
Yeah. So you have certain general approaches that differ between these two crew from your experience as a means of expressing the best, closest to the true nature of that crew.
Yes, I think nature, sometimes, you know, certain vintages are difficult, but I think that in anybody there's a good sign, even if apparently there's seems to be all bad. It's never all bad. So that's, I think it's our role as entrepreneurs, winemakers of the whole planet, to try to restitute the beauty of nature which exists. And that doesn't mean that we will standardize the wines, absolutely not. But I think it would be difficult to imagine a Muzinier, a Benmar, or Oregon wines, or Californian wines, all over the planet to be bad wines. It's not the purpose. We want to give the most aesthetic wines. And most of the time, I think if you do that, you are automatically very close to the terroir.
You notice the analogies and the metaphors that François likes to use tend to revolve around personalities. And actually, it's kind of interesting to me because I've tried to do a little bit of amateur research in the psychological literature to explore the analogies between facial recognition and what happens when we recognize the vintage of a wine or the character of the wine. When we were tasting the 2007 vintage from Cask, François told me he thought that the exuberance of the young wines was a reflection of their relief and exhilaration at having escaped what looked to be in store for them in that vintage. Now, of course, certainly that's metaphoric and, yes, anthropomorphic, but I trust, François, that you think that there's something, that there is some deeper significance to trying to imagine the vines and the grapes in human terms, and perhaps even to put yourself in the position of the grape in determining what how to handle the vintage. Huh?
So I just want to give you relief that I'm not going mad. Not so far. But anyway, I'm convinced, and that's not just the Muzinier and Benmar, that all the wines are, it's like a person, it's like wine persons. And sometimes you have to, when you want to have the best dialogue with these persons, maybe it's interesting to take their place. We call this empathy. Empathy, maybe in English? Empathy? Empathy meaning to try to take the place of the person. It's not diplomatic, or it's not a trick. But just to try to understand the person by taking the place of the person, taking his place, in order to have more dialogue, to have more contact with him.
I think I'm going to ask you if you have some questions. One of the comments that we received yesterday was people would like to have us say a little more about our impressions of the wine. I'm happy to do that, although have some trepidation because one doesn't like to put too many words into people's mouths. So I think we'll start a little bit earlier on questions in the hope that perhaps some of your questions will simply relate to making some observations about what's in the glass in front of you and asking us to elaborate on it or to comment on what we think makes for the characteristic in the glass. So.
You know, I think for New World growers and winemakers, maybe haven't had as long...
Sorry, could you speak louder? Excuse me.
I've never been accused of that.
No.
But it's lovely.
It's just for my English. Excuse me.
Okay. For us in the New World, we haven't been dealing with our vineyards, usually, for as long a time. And I think... that after a while, the Burgundians actually just start to know the personalities of their wine. So I wanted to first state that I think you stop sort of describing them in terms of fruit flavors and sort of a laundry list of descriptors, and you start trying to find other metaphors for something that's multi-generational, that you've known it for that long. And that's part of what I hear that you're trying to say, and I've certainly experienced that over there. But I'd like to know something about... there's kind of a debate in Burgundy that's not seen as a debate, but I see it as one. I have friends and not friends who I've visited that talk about this fermentation classique, where whatever temperature the grapes come in at, you just let it do its thing, a bit like... with wild yeast, but I'm talking about temperature, and they do 12 days no matter what. And then you've got other Burgundians that are more like my impression of the New World, deeply involved with thinking, how long does this need a cold soak, how long should that be, and how long should the cuvaison be, and post-maceration. So I would love to hear your comment, not just on yourself, but on other Burgundians. Is this fermentation classique going on for some people, and does it reflect the year? It's a cold year, things don't ferment for a while. It's a hot year, things ferment right away. What do you think of that approach?
I'd like to just to jump in and add to your question, Naomi, because I realize we forgot to and neglected to bring out the aspect of élevage itself, the cask maturation, which, as François is about to tell you, he lays great stock on. And, of course, the issue of how long or when you bottle is something that no matter how much of a formula you attempt to follow or how passive you want to try to convince your listener that you are in the cellar, that's a choice you have to make. It's an arrêt. And so, François? Whether there's a tension between this concept of letting it go and the concept of making the decisions and talking of rational discussion of how to proceed at each step.
It's a very easy question. but it's an interesting question. Well, anyway, you know, I'm not here... it's not my job. I'm not here to give global impressions about Burgundy, because I think it's not my role here. But I prefer to talk about what I do, and it's a very complex question, because the point with Lusigny and Amoureuse and the wines of the village is that I'm convinced, and I'm not the sole producer of Chambon, to be convinced that these wines deserve a lot of care and a lot of attention in terms of being hands off. That means that at first it's the point. If I were vinifying wines in Gervais-Chambertin, why not? It's a marvelous image, and the wines are very interesting. But I would discuss probably very differently, because the wines of this village and the Ma is the first clue about this. The Ma needs, again, much more, and less hands off with the Bunma. But Gevrey, the wines of Gevrey, I think, even though I've never made wines from Gevrey, by the way, but I've tasted quite a lot of wines of Gevrey, and these wines, this terroir needs to be, you have to have a contact. So that's why that first statement means that I don't think it. I think it would be quite difficult with these wines, Musigny, to all the time have a sort of idea of being obliged to do a cold soaking for, let's say, I don't know, 10 days, with a certain amount of sulfur, with peptolytic enzymes, with and so on and so on. But if you take, I'll give you an example, 08, which is a very classic vintage, we picked quite late, and the temperature was very cold. And I didn't eat up 08, even though it was 10, 12 degrees. I just had the same idea that maybe I'm not exactly answering the question, but it could be also another information to try to understand my view, not just my personal view. I think it's important to imagine as if you had a sort of extension of the climatic conditions, the vineyards, and then the winemaking. And it's very important to avoid any standardization by being able to keep the print of the vintage, the climatic print of the vintage. So, but if, imagine a hot vintage, I don't speak about 03, because that's a very, very, very hot, but imagine that you bring the grapes at 20, 20, 22, I will cool down. I think it's this intervention will be a benefit to the terroir, because you have a slow start. But I will, when I say 15, the amount of sulfur is very low. It's, well, not that low, but it's 4 grams per hectoliter. Because 4 grams per hectoliter, I think, is that preserves, that avoids any sulfur is aggressive, and that avoids any aggressivity for the berries. So I don't know if I really answer. It's a very complex question, so I hope I give you a few information.
Yeah, and one dimension of that question, of course, is really applicable to any wine region, but I think especially Burgundy, which is simply that people define their methods, whether subconsciously or expressly, in terms of the tradition, which in the Côte d'Or is certainly different from one village to another. It's the reason why you'll sometimes see terroir doubters talk about the so-called postcode paradox, the idea that, you know, you make wine to fit the model that you have in in your imagination of how wine should be in that particular commune, and so it's a self-referential, it's a self-justifying but of course, ultimately, no matter how established a tradition is, you still have to ask the question whether it is the right thing for the terroir or whether the wine is better or less good. And I mean, I would just say there's no way to duck that responsibility. By calling it tradition doesn't make you as a vigneron any less responsible for the decision.
Anyway, I think it's part of the human diversity that we have in any wine region. And if you want to do something, and if you like it, you really have to do it. Our job as winemaker is a job, you have to be passionate. If you do something and you don't like it, I don't think it works.
Some more questions?
I've been struggling with a question regarding vine age and root systems.
Excuse me. Please lower. I'm sorry for these remarks, but there's a bit of noise, and sorry about that.
Right. Sure. I've been struggling with the question of vine age and root systems depth. I'm told by some vineyard consultants that below 2 feet, so about 0.6 meters, the soil is very anaerobic and it's not so important what's going on, but at the same time, I'm very convinced, as I'm sure most of us in this room are, that old vines give more complexity and depth in the wine, but is it really because the roots are getting deeper, or is it other factors that we maybe don't have fully understood?
And I've been told by famous viticulturalists that it doesn't matter when you harvest. I mean, some rather counterintuitive things get said by scientists at times.
You know, it depends on where you are. Because if you remember my drawings, our situation is a slope situation anyway. And if you are in Premier Cru or even in village, why not? You have the drainage. If I have correctly understood, we don't have any lack of oxygen that much when we go deeper in our soils. And the limestone we have, that's the karstic system. Karstic meaning the limestone able to the water goes down and down, and we have water anyway. It's not the problem, but you can go deep and deep and still have enough oxygen and not being in too wet conditions that the roots can really go very deep.
If I could just venture also, perhaps a smart answer to your question, but I think even as a non-scientist, I would venture to say that if the roots go deep, there has to be from an evolutionary standpoint, a reason. And if there is, then it has to cast out in terms of plant physiology, because what else is the plant there for? So, I mean, I would just say there is a significance if you have a deeper penetration. It's only a question then in terms of understanding the mechanism by which what we call terroir effect takes place to figure out how important it is for the aspects of plant physiology that matter to us. But again, I mean, I know this is a smart-ass answer, but I mean, I so often get into discussions, especially with geologists and issues of terroir, and it takes us maybe 45 minutes to even begin to feel like we're on the same plane, because from my standpoint, they're saying things that seem completely non-intuitive, and of course, from their standpoint, I'm spouting mystic gibberish. So. Some more questions? Just a comment I'd like to make also. I mean, nobody's ventured any comments intellectually. One of the things that strikes me over the a long period of time tasting Bonmar and Musigny, and especially in tasting these two wines here, and one of the things that I love about Pinot Noir, one of the three or four things that I list when people ask me why is this the most exciting red grape variety and why is it the most seductive, is the issues of texture, the dimension of texture and the feel, mouthfeel of the wine, which is certainly no easier to describe than the tastes and aromas. But I'd love to hear somebody's comment. I will put words in your mouth if forced to. But I find that there's a systemic textural difference between Bonmar and Musigny every single year, regardless of what the weather brings. Somebody want to comment on that? Somebody was going to. Appeared ready to rise to the occasion here. I mean, am I daft? I mean, is there something we can call the textural dimension, A and B? Is it different in this instance, at least, between these two wines? I mean, I think about the separation. You know, after you swallow, you have a totally different effect.
Yeah, and it's also the attitude, which is strikingly different. The attitude of the Bonmar being so direct. And this is very uncommon in our commune, much more in the northern part of the Cordillera, which doesn't mean that the vines are uninteresting if you go up north. Of course they are not. But it's, at first, it's the behavior of the vine, which is extremely different. And Mazzini having also the certain distance. The vines are very young, you know. It's I thought it was interesting to bring that vintage because it's a terroir-driven vintage. 07, that's too early. I bought all the 07 in the spring. And 05 is egocentric. 05 is 05. 05 says 05 first and the terroir next. It's a very good vintage anyway, but a bit less driven, a bit less terroir-driven than 06. And 06 is quite interesting because it's also a very calm vintage. You can really, 06 is a, is like a friend. And when people were tasting in the cellars, not only in our cellar, but in all the village, I imagine I was looking at, observing people, and people were beginning to be quiet and calming down. 05 had a different, aspect, gave to the people a sort of excitement.
Yeah, in that sense, I see 06 as a quintessentially Mussigny vintage. I mean, for me, the persistence in Bonnard is always this sort of sappy persistence, and it has, it expresses its energy in a very different way. And then you have the more sort of very ethereal, refined, caressing sort of a textural impression in the finish of the Mussigny, which is perfectly suited to the nature, for me, to the virtues of the 06 vintage. Anybody else want to ask one more quick question? Go ahead. Question is, what's the relationship between the notion of minerality in wine and energy, as Francois has been using those terms?
It's first we have to define minerality. It's not easy, but I'm sure you see what I mean. We could have symbols which could define minerality. Ice is minerality. A crystal is minerality. A clear water. A lake, very limpid lake, that's minerality.
And sap, resin, amber.
So I wanted to say that in the ruins of our village, I think that what is giving the strength is the freshness and the minerality, and not actually the body. There is a body anyway, obviously, but the body is not really showing. And I have the impression of that minerality propelling the vintage, giving, I call this energy, and giving a motion to the wine. Instead of having a wine built, constructed with body, with structure, and most of the time these wines, because of their weight, are more static than dynamic.
All right. And we'll do one more quick.
My question would be the longevity of each of these. They're drinking lovely, they're no six. What would you see them being their
life? Likely aging curve of the wines.
You know, it's when you, I will try to answer the question. It's a very difficult question because at first you have to, I think we have to wait that the wines open. That means you don't have to craft the wines. You don't have to open the wines before, 1 hour before. But, well, it's a human attitude to try to know, to think about the longevity of a wine. So that would be maybe, I've forgotten my crystal ball. but there's a potential in this vintage. I'll give an answer, maybe 15, from 15 to 20 for the Mussigny to start. But, sorry for that remark, but is it, when you know a nice guy, are you going to wonder if for how long he's going to live. I mean, you just take benefit of that kind person. And anyway, then when the wine has begun to open, it will be up to your taste, either to prefer when the wine is beginning to have a certain maturity, or why not, to like the wine when it's very old.
Okay, well, thanks very much. And don't let anyone pry the Monsignor Bonnard from your hands until you've finished, but it is time for us to go to the next part of the program, so thanks again.
Thank you. Francois and David, thank you both very much. Obviously a very poetic and meditative view of de Vogüé, of Chambord Musigny, and of these wines. I happen to have a hole in my cellar, so I'm glad to have had the experience with the wines. Now we have about a half hour before the afternoon activities begin. Don't forget, the Pétanque tournament is going on right now. I know Cyril Audouin was very happy that he'd moved to the next level, so you can cheer him on and others.
They were Team Musigny and Team Bonnard, but apparently they didn't think of that in time.
Oh, that's good. Well, also, there are various other activities, including book signings. Jancis, of course, our friend John Hager, will be there as well, so don't miss that. And let me see, New Zealand white wines, cheeses of the world, and a taste of place, I guess a chance to actually eat dirt. There you have it. So thank you all very, very much, and we'll see you shortly.